To become a Unitarian Universalist minister, one of the questions that often comes up with the Ministerial Fellowship Committee before whom you have to sit and respond to whatever questions they want to ask you for 45 minutes to an hour, is what difference does your theology make in how you live your daily life? My response, which I suspect is similar to many of you, is that my Unitarian Universalist theology makes a tremendous difference in how I live my daily life. Since I have the luxury of, in many respects, coming from a place of privilege, male privilege, white privilege, other sense of privileges, I occasionally find myself thinking how much easier life would be if I didn't believe in UU principles like the inherent worth and dignity of every person, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, which can turn up pesky injustices that have to be dealt with, respect for the interdependent web of all existence instead of it's just all about me. If I didn't believe in those and other UU principles, I could likely feel much more content with the injustices of the status quo, many of which unduly benefit me. But that would be an easier, not a better way. And I say easier, not better, because I, like many of you, know the power and the beauty that comes from seeing and embracing and celebrating every person's inherent worth and dignity. When that comes to be recognized, whether from glimpses of Martin Luther King's dream becoming a reality or the breathtaking spread of same-sex marriage rights across our country, easier for those in power is not always better. It rarely is. And we all know that being in the same room with your enemies, though, those for whom it's hardest to recognize their inherent worth and dignity, being in the same room with them, much less loving them, is not easy. But easier is not always better. And this whole idea of loving your enemies, even considering that, is one of those ways of being in the world that would never have occurred to me if I hadn't grown up and been a part of religious community. Those are the sorts of ways of seeing the world that religious community invites us into. It's the sort of values that we seek to grow and challenge each other about here at UUCF, to call one another to seek truth, compassion, and justice, far beyond what we would be likely to do if left to our own devices. Left to myself, loving your enemies is not something that would have ever occurred to me, because love is precisely the opposite of what I typically feel toward my enemies. And although I grew up in a Bible-based, conservative Christian congregation, I don't remember ever hearing an emphasis on loving your enemies. Did anyone grow up in a congregation that regularly preached loving your enemies? But it's right. Oh, you did? Good. We'll talk later. Was it Mennonite or Anabaptist? Okay. We'll talk. Very interesting. In Matthew 5:44, it's right there. First gospel, Matthew 5:44. If you even get five chapters into the New Testament, it's talking about loving your enemies. Matthew 5:44, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. The same passage is repeated twice in Luke 6:27 and 35. But the first time I remember hearing someone take seriously Jesus' teachings to love your enemies was when I was graduated from high school and starting to learn about the Bible and other religions for myself. And I learned about the life of Clarence Jordan from the early 20th century. Do any of you know much about Clarence Jordan? Just a few? Okay. Future sermon forthcoming. For now, Jordan began studying agriculture at the University of Georgia in 1929, the same year that the Great Depression started. During his spare time, he felt drawn to study the Bible. He'd grown up a good Southern Baptist boy. And he felt drawn especially to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5-7. If you're drawn particularly to Jesus' teachings, that's a powerful place to start, just those three chapters. As part of his undergraduate studies, Jordan was also in ROTC. And one day during cavalry practice, they still did that back then, those words he had been studying from Scripture started resounding in his head as he went through those cavalry drills that he'd done 1,000 times before. But that day, each time he went through the drill, he was in the line, on his horse, they would ride forward and stab the practice dummies through the heart with their sword and then ride around and get back in line. So he'd stab it with his saber. He kept hearing every time, love your enemies. And he'd ride back around, love your enemies. And he'd ride back around, love your enemies. He resigned from ROTC in the middle of that practice. His commanding officer tried to convince him to become a chaplain. You know, you can still be part of this, but he said simply, I can't encourage someone else to do what I myself would not do. Next, Jordan went to Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and eventually combined his knowledge of agriculture with his desire to take seriously and radically Jesus' teachings, and he founded an interracial Christian community with a shared purse. They ate together, they practiced nonviolence, they bought 440 acres of land in Americus, Georgia, south of Atlanta. That was 1942. In the Deep South, that he was founding an interracial Christian community, more than a decade before the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. There's a lot more, again, that I'd like to tell you about his life, including how that place, Koinonia Farms, that comes from the Greek New Testament word for community, koinonia, helped directly inspire Habitat for Humanity, that Millard Fuller, who founded Habitat for Humanity, visited Koinonia Farms. If any of you know the biblical story of the rich young ruler, that was Millard. And he was converted at Koinonia Farms. They were doing a Habitat for Humanity-like thing. And then Millard was inspired and built what is now Habitat for Humanity International. But for now, with the simple goal of everyone has inherent worth and dignity right and should have a simple, decent place to live, that everyone should have that. That's the mission of Habitat. But for now, I offer just that simple piece of Jordan's story and his commitment to racial justice and to nonviolence in the face of what was to be tremendous persecution and resistance from the KKK and the local community. Dorothy Day visited their community. She got shot at. It's a really a long and powerful story. But I offer that as one of the many examples of the transformation that can come, in this case, from not wanting to kill your racist enemies, but from committing to the long, slow work of being in community and befriending them, who wrongly see themselves as your enemies, and working to change the systems that support racism. As Dr. King said in his 1967 Christmas Sermon for Peace, we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will appeal to your heart and conscience, and we will win you in the process, and that victory will be a double victory. Indeed, the Christian mystic and philosopher Beatrice Bruchot, in her book, The Holy Thursday Revolution, writes that the only way to authentically practice Jesus' command to love your neighbor as yourself is not to see your neighbor as different from yourself, because then they're not yourself, right? She says it's to see that your neighbor, in the deepest sense, she would say in God, is part of yourself. That's the only way to love your neighbor as yourself, is out of that lived experience. And that sense of deep connection and interdependence is also part of the Buddhist tradition, as well as our seventh UU principle of the interdependent web of all existence, that we are all connected, and what any of us does or fails to do affects the rest of that web. If you think about a spider web, you shake one part, it affects the rest. Ethan Nickturn, a contemporary Buddhist teacher and the founder of the Interdependence Project, frames this perspective as a shift from the three S's to the three C's, the move from separate, selfish, and scared to connection, compassion, and courage. The practice of making enemies and of experiencing others as separate from you, it's a learned behavior. It's a practice. But it's one we practice a lot, right? We're really good at that practice of making enemies, better than making free throws, right? We practice it all the time. We're taught to practice it in our culture, to imitate it. But it often leaves us scared and acting on our own self-interest. But there's a different, more expansive, life-giving way of being in this world. At their best, wisdom traditions such as Judaism, Christianity, and Buddhism invite us to experience the world through deep connection and interdependence with one another. And when we do that, compassion, when you experience your connection with others, compassion and courage can emerge about what is possible. And that shift is what that 3-2-1 shadow practice is all about. I'd be interested to hear afterwards if any of you, you know, different spiritual practices work more or less well for different people. For myself, when I've really entered into that practice and taken even 15 minutes to sort of spend 5 minutes on each of those three steps, I've sometimes found with a disturbing person, I've sometimes felt energy physically releasing from my body and sort of felt wired afterwards, that I could almost feel that that thing that I'd been repressing about that person released, that I could physically feel that. I don't know if any of you had the time to feel that this morning, but that 3-2-1 shadow practice, that when you do find yourself hyperbolically reacting to someone, it can be a really powerful practice to do. Some people like to do it meditatively. Some people like to journal it. Some people like to draw it. They draw those three parts of moving from seeing that person in the third person, way over there, about them, to the second person, dialoguing with them, what do they have to say to me, and then seeing yourself, seeing the world, including yourself, from that person's perspective. It can be a really, really powerful experiment. And to risk discovering any similarities between that person, that enemy, and yourself. Buddhist teachers Sharon Salzberg and Robert Thurman, in their new book, Love Your Enemies, How to Break the Anger Habit and Be a Whole Lot Happier, tell the story of a man who was so displeased with the sight of his shadow and the sound of his footsteps that he was determined to be rid of both. The method of this fearful man that he hit upon was to run away from his shadow. But every step he took, his shadow accompanied him without the slightest difficulty. The man concluded he wasn't running fast enough, so he stepped up his pace, running faster and faster, stopping until finally he dropped dead. This poor man failed to realize that if he merely stepped into the shade, his shadow would vanish instantly. And if he sat down and stayed still, there would be no more footsteps. So are you taking that time to look inside yourself, to go into the shadow place? And those footsteps, you know, it's what sometimes say, wherever you go, there you are, right? So you might as well just slow down and get your stuff together and figure it out wherever you happen to be. This ancient Chinese tale about the shadow invites us to see the fruitlessness of trying to defeat our enemies if we don't change ourselves and the larger systems and institutions in which we find ourselves. Salzberg and Thurman relatedly share the challenging Buddhist teaching, updated to a contemporary setting, that one should be happier to come down for breakfast in the morning and meet your worst enemy at the door than to greet a TV prize show host ringing the doorbell with a $10 million check for you. Now, Salzberg and Thurman readily admit that they're not actually that evolved and they would take the money and run. But the point is that with the $10 million, wherever you go, there you are. You still have a lot of the same problems and issues and will bring all those pathologies with you in whatever ways you spend your windfall. But the opportunity to authentically and compassionately encounter your perceived worst enemy is really an opportunity for profound potential transformation. Many stories of lottery winners readily attest that their money, their fortunes, left them shaped much more by the three S's. It left them feeling separate from others, selfish, and scared. It didn't leave them feeling connected, compassionate, and courageous. So which one would be the greater gift, ringing your doorbell? And an encounter with your worst enemy, although potentially a scary experience, the first of those three S's, can be an experience of separateness and selfishness. It can also be an invitation to recognize and to integrate those shadow parts of yourself that your enemy is triggering through practicing connection, compassion, and courage. What is it like to see the world from your enemy's perspective? What are some similarities between you and your enemy? For now, I'll leave you with one final thought from the Universalist half of our Unitarian Universalist tradition. Universalism began as a rejection of the idea that anyone's finite actions in this life, that anyone's finite actions, no matter how repugnant, could even possibly justify an infinite punishment in an afterlife. This logic led our Universalist forebears to promote the idea of universal salvation for all people. Over time, the emphasis shifted from concern about the next world and whether anyone was going to hell to this world and loving the hell out of this world that we sometimes create in fighting with our enemies. So on this morning, when we have been reflecting on the challenging teachings of integrating your unconscious and of loving your enemies, I invite you to experiment in the coming weeks with this universalist wisdom from the Hindu guru Neem Karoli Baba, who taught his students, don't throw anyone out of your heart. What might that change for you? Don't throw anyone out of your heart. What might that unlock within you? to experiment with that universalist spiritual practice, to hold the peace and well-being of all beings, even your enemies, in your heart, to be able increasingly to say to all beings, even your enemies, Namaste. Namaste.